season 8 and I have some cracking guests lined up. We'll be diving into all things leadership, teamwork, engagement, mental well-being and high performance. We have the conversations that matter about putting the human factor back into business, because when we get people right, we get business right. If you want to find out more about how to develop an experience that brings out the best in people, get in touch. And if you like the idea of building your leaders, managers and culture, one experiment at a time, Leadership Labs may well be for you. Check out details in the show notes. I'm your host, Lisa, psychologist and psychotherapist and founder of It's Time for Change. Thank you for joining me on Beyond the Water Cooler. So I'm welcoming Phil Holcroft, a decorated combat pilot with a 20-year military career that's seen him dodging bullets and all the way through to being the executive senior leadership of defence. For his final role in the armed forces, Phil had the privilege of designing and delivering the senior leadership programme at the United Kingdom Defence Academy. And now officially a veteran, which I think is quite amusing, because it makes you sound really old, Phil. He's continuing to pursue his life's purpose, which is helping others to conquer big, hairy, audacious goals. Welcome, Phil.
Oh, great to be here, Lisa. I am actually feeling very old today after doing a little hairy, audacious goal at the weekend. So definitely feeling quite fatigued.
Hang on, you can't leave it there. It wasn't a little hairy, audacious goal. Tell the listeners what you were doing on Saturday.
So I set myself a challenge of running 100 miles, taking part in the Chester 100 mile ultramarathon. And it was a bit of a test of walking the walk, because I now work with executives, teams and organisations trying to help them achieve big, hairy, audacious goals. So this is me having some skin in the game and seeing if I could walk the walk. And it was tough, but it went really well. But I'm definitely feeling every bit of my 44 years today.
Really well. You came first, I've just heard. That's very, very well.
So well done. I managed to sneak it, yeah.
So your role at the Defence Academy allowed you to sort of draw on your knowledge, your experience, and just your whole kind of what life has brought for you so far in terms of putting together lots of stuff around resilience, high performance that really interests you. And what I'm really interested in doing today is unpicking that a little bit by hearing your story. So, you know, there's every time I speak to you, you're doing something amazing and it's based on something amazing you've done in the past and what you've learned from that. So I'm really interested in unpicking that a little bit. So other people who are in a situation where they might want to be taking on a new challenge, or they're just feeling a bit overwhelmed with stuff, can maybe have a different way of thinking about things. Certainly from my point of view, I was interested in having this conversation because I think, you know, everyone talks still a lot about the pandemic, but I think regardless of that pace of change, stuff happens, which just sets people on a slightly different course. And it's about how people respond to that, or whether they actively try and get back on their old path, or whether they are open to new opportunities and feel equipped to be able to deal with what comes, you know, the unexpected as well as the expected. So I know you're going to have lots to share with us today. Do you want to start by telling us a little bit about how you started on that whole journey?
Yeah, okay, that's a great chance to give a bit of background. Thank you, Lisa. So my final role in the Defence Academy, that was doing the leadership development programme for, I guess, the very senior leadership of defence. These are people who are earmarked to go on to lead the Army, the Navy, the Royal Air Force, and also the government organisations as well. So it was a real privilege to be able to bring to bear everything which life has exposed me to, the military has exposed me to. But I guess what underpins that was a life-changing event back in 2014. To 2014, I'll take you back. I was 11 years into my military career at that point. I was a combat helicopter pilot, and everything was on rails. Life was as good as it gets. I remember thinking in one weekend in June, it can't get better than this. I remember three things. On a Saturday, I got to fly the Queen's birthday fly past. So I was at the front helicopter flying over the top of Buckingham Palace with this enormous formation behind me, you know, being able to wave at the Queen as we go over the top. So that was military on a high. The next day, it was Father's Day, and I got to spend it with my two young girls and my amazing wife. And I thought, wow, you know, my family is in such a good place. I'm so lucky. And also, there was a local triathlon, and being an endurance nutter that I am, I was able to do that little triathlon and cross the line. I managed to sneak first place on that day as well, with my girls in my arms. I remember thinking, this is as good as it gets. And if you'd have asked me then, you know, have you mastered resilience? Have you, you know, mastered, you know, high performance? And have you got leadership cracked? I'd say to you, yes, absolutely, 100%. I've got it nailed. But the truth, Lisa, I had a pretty wafer thin sort of understanding of it. And I really came unstuck about a month later. So fast forward 30 days, we're July 2014, and I come home from work, just been flying, and my wife Beth says to me, "Phil, I don't think Isla's very well. I'm not happy." And Isla's our youngest daughter. She's 22 months old. She'd had this persistent cough and cold, and even though the doctor had prescribed her antibiotics, she just didn't seem to be responding. And knowing my wife has far better instincts than me, we went to the hospital. And within a matter of hours, our lives completely unraveled, and we got delivered the gut-wrenching news that Isla had leukemia. And it completely, completely tipped my world upside down. You know, when I think about the horrors of Iraq or Afghanistan, it didn't come close. It just pales into insignificance to the horror and the fear and how scared I felt right then. Sat on the sidelines watching my daughter walk this tightrope of life and death. And that was where I really started to learn about resilience. And I realized it was so much more than doing tough stuff or doing hard training. It was much, much more than that, much more complex, much more nuanced. And to be honest, Lisa, I learned so many lessons from watching my wife. I'd been of this stoic sort of leadership brand. You know, that's typically how we got trained in the military. Stiff upper lip, you know, follow me, chaps, here we go. And actually that completely didn't work. And my wife, you know, she hadn't had military training, but she was able to be vulnerable. She was able to invite people in and explain how tough she was finding it and get that support. And for me, sat on the sidelines, I realized I was totally ill-equipped to deal with it. And actually, resilience was much more than being tough. It was about inviting people in, using your social network and those around you to gain that support. So it became a bit of a journey, to be honest, Lisa. And I definitely had an epiphany sat in that hospital bed. It was a 2.5 year journey while Isla went through this grueling process of chemotherapy. And I'm delighted to say she came out the other side. But my epiphany was that I wanted to do something to sort of give back. I wanted to do something which I guess used what I was good at to try and make a difference. And that difference was to try and raise money for the miracle workers who'd saved my daughter's life. Also, I wanted to connect with Isla. I wanted to understand what she'd been through, this incredibly tough time, the fear, the uncertainty, the pain. And so I set myself this series of 5 challenges, which represented each year she needed to remain in remission to be cured. And the only rules were It had to be right on the edge of the possible. There had to be no guarantee of success. And also, I had to give it my heart and soul, put everything into it. And this led to a series of pretty crazy endurance challenges, which culminated in rowing across the Atlantic in the final year. And through that whole process, I learned so much. You know, from the rowing, I learned about leadership, teamwork, communication, trust, and vulnerability. Through the 100 milers, I learned about what we are each capable of and all the self-limiting beliefs which we impose on ourselves, which are just glass ceilings. And so it was an incredible journey of discovery. And now I guess my mission, Lisa, is to try and share some of what I've learned from the military, from the adversity of what my daughter went through, and through my passion for high performance, and just trying to support people in their dreams.
So I'm really curious. I mean, that it still gets me, that story. And I know, you know, you've shared that with me previous to this conversation today, but as a mum, you just think, gosh, you just can't imagine that day when you hear something like that. It's every parent's sort of worst nightmare. And I was really curious about how you were able to observe your wife and to see her response and her ability to be vulnerable and to receive help and so on. And you realize that that was a million miles from your experience being in the armed forces. And it's, I'm curious to know how you made that, because you were aware of that, but then how you made that leap from what your existence had been for a long time, stiff upper lip and so on, to being more vulnerable. Because it's all very well saying I need to be more vulnerable, but actually putting yourself in that position and having changing your mindset and so on, that's a big ask, isn't it?
Well, I'm a big believer in this. It's been something I've flipped on. I guess, as I said, I've been brought up watching these heroes, in inverted commas, do daring do's on the battlefield and show no sign of weakness. And I just assumed that was the way it's done. That is what I need to aspire to. Actually, having unraveled and watched my wife do so much better in such dire circumstances, it's changed my outlook and my philosophy. Now I try and lead with complete authenticity, but vulnerability as well. And I don't see vulnerability as a weakness. I see it as a towering strength if you can harness it. When I work in teams and I work for leaders who are willing to be vulnerable, except they are not perfect, I trust them instinctively so much more. I know they're not trying to cover something up. And I know as a team, we can do so much better if the leader is willing to say, hey, every time we do a product launch, I really struggle with the public speaking, the on stage. You respect them so much more and you'll do everything you can to support them. Mm. And if the whole team can get in that situation, you get to a place where they will instinctively know where they need to support each other, where they need to help out. And it might be, okay, you know, Steve or Lisa may be the leader, but I am far better equipped to deal with this situation. I will take the lead on this. I will do this part of the project, be it I'm good with numbers or I'm good with speaking with people. And it just means the whole team's performance can go through the roof. And I'll just add one more example to that where it got really reinforced. And this was rowing across the Atlantic with three incredible friends. It was the most intense environment I've ever operated in. It was a 8-meter rowing boat, putting everything on the line for 36 days. And we recognized that unless we were able to be completely vulnerable with each other, it was going to be a disaster for the team. We weren't going to be able to work together. So we agreed before we set out that we'd set a really low threshold for where we'd raise issues, where we'd raise concerns. And it might be, you know, one of the team saying at 2 in the morning, I'm in a dark, dark hole right now. I don't know if I can go on. I don't know if I can cope. And we completely respected that. We completely understood it. None of the team had anything to prove to each other. They'd all done incredible stuff in their career. And just being able to say, it's okay, I'm here for you. We could do this. So that low threshold is something else which I sort of take forward. And if we can raise issues early in a team, it means they can be tackled early. In the boat situation, there was no 5 o'clock, you get to go home, no weekend where you can go home and vent. This had to be dealt with there and then. But I think it does bleed across to the workplace, to home life. There's definitely something in there.
I think, I mean, it's really good to hear those examples because we talk a lot about, authenticity, vulnerability, and so on. And I sometimes hear people say, well, I am doing that. I am being vulnerable. I'm being authentic, but it's almost paying lip service to it. And it's understanding what that really looks like. So having a conversation with your team to be quite clear about what that threshold is and that any doubts, any concerns, or any ideas, or just throw it out. There's no such thing as a bad suggestion, or no one's ever going to be penalized or criticized for raising something. It doesn't matter what it is, because you never know what that might lead to. But having those very explicit conversations, and I think sometimes people struggle knowing quite what to say or how to demonstrate that
Yes.
vulnerability and that authenticity. That's the bit that they're like, well, I want to do it, and I think I'm doing it. And you think from the outside, they're not doing it particularly well, but their want is there, their intention is there. It's just about the language. And I think actually having almost like a bank of kind of statements or questions or the language I can use, which just says, I don't know, or I'm not sure, or could you help me, or you're better at this than me, could you help, or and actually just having those almost those kind of sentence starters that they can then finish the rest of it for themselves, I think is really helpful.
Totally agree, Lisa. I don't think it has to be about sharing some tragic event. It's sharing what's going on. Again, my wife, who's a civil servant, she worked for a leader who I think implemented this brilliant strategy where they had a set aside meeting where the only agenda item was what's going on in your life. And that was the only agenda item. No any other business, or I'm just going to shoehorn this in. It was a catch up. And the leader really set the tone by just don't talk about any difficulties. It might be, oh, I'm really struggling with childcare, or and it could be anything, but it humanized them, and it made people trust them, and it meant you could also share what was going on in your life. So I think one is the actual divulgence of the information, but the other important factor is how it's received and how it's dealt with. And I think as team members and leaders, we've got to receive it well and support it well. And I think if people really feel they can be vulnerable, wow, I think it can really untap their potential because that they're not hindered by it. It's no longer a burden that they feel it the team's got it.
And I think I like your word about humanizing, because again, I think when we can have those real conversations with people, which is about what's going on for you, good or not so good, and just how you're feeling about it, and just having that sort of general chat. And we do that at a human level with taking off our roles in terms of I'm your manager, or this is how we relate to each other in a professional way. We connect. And as soon as you have that connect, and that builds that connection, you build the trust, and then you build the psychological safety, and then that enables people to be more authentic and vulnerable. And it starts literally from that human connection, doesn't it? And I think sometimes people get so stuck with, well, I'm a manager, and therefore if I ask a question and this other person comes up with a difficulty they're having or a question, that means I've got to know what to say, and I've got to know how to solve it, and I've got to be able to advise. And you're like, actually, you don't have to do any of that. Just if you were a friend, you wouldn't worry so much about having a natural conversation. You might just say, well, that sounds really tough. Let's work it out together. Let's think about it together. Or you just show empathy without having to solve a problem. But I think those, the roles can sometimes get in the way of people being human.
Yeah, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the hybrid or virtual working environments. I think that can almost amplify it. We can really manufacture what people see. We could take our time, make sure the backdrop's exactly what we want. They're seeing less of you as a person. And I wonder if that probably hinders it, in my opinion. I don't know if what your experience is and any strategies for getting around that in terms of quality, Lisa.
I think it reminds me of the sort of social media aspect, doesn't it? It's like you just put on social media what you want the world to see, and it just makes everyone think that your life is perfect and they have no idea what's really going on behind closed doors. I'm a real fan of, you know, if people are working remotely, being able to, I call them walk and talks. So getting off a screen. Now, I know a lot of people talk about we need to have the screen because we need to be able to see people. And if we can't see people, then, you know, that's, we don't know what's really going on. A lot of people hate sitting in front of a screen. It's not their natural way to be. They feel like they're under the spotlight. It's really intense looking at people. Whereas if you're in a room, you know, people are sitting around, people are naturally looking out of a window and so on, far less intense. And I think when we are outside and we're walking, so I'll plug myself into my phone, I'll be chatting to someone who, wherever they are in the country, and we can chat. We'll chat about what the weather's like, where are you walking now? I can hear traffic or I can hear birds, and you just talk. And then you just talk about, I don't know, what's going on, like who are you, who are your friends or your family, and where do you live, and what's your role, and all that stuff just emerges more naturally, because it's almost like going for a walk with someone in a park, which is very different, I think, to a very formal setting, which everyone, you know, with Teams or Zoom, it feels much more formal, and people are then very aware of how to come across in a particular way. You get rid of all that need to mask, and actually when you know your team well, just knowing how chatty they are, or knowing their tone of voice, or whether they're quieter than normal, or, you know, you should be able to just pick up on some of those signs a little bit more. But the fact is, if you're having good quality conversations, even if you don't pick up necessarily the signs, that person's more likely to tell you or talk to you about something because they have that connection. So again, it's removing the onus to, I've got to be a detective and work at what's going on. Actually, it's more likely to naturally arise if we have that relationship.
Yeah, no, that's great. No, I wholly agree with that. I think it's the same as if you're sat face to face with someone over a desk. It's very formal. It's quite stuffy, and you're not really seeing or hearing the real them. Whereas you can do something side by side or walking. So yeah, big fan of you walking and talking, Lisa. I was slightly worried you're going to suggest that today. And given this weekend's antics, it would have been a bad idea.
You'd have been hobbling.
A lot of old man noises, I'm afraid.
So your experience with your daughter was really quite life-changing, and that was a pivotal moment for you. And through your roles that followed, you were very much more interested in leadership, and you learned a lot about leadership and so on. And I know that's what you're really interested in now, in terms of how to lead well and how to lead high performing teams. What else can you share with us, Phil, in terms of lessons learned or advice about how to think about leadership and performance and resilience?
I feel like I've got a lot to share, but it's because I was so unprepared for what happened back in 2014. And actually, it's because I was far less capable, far less knowledgeable than I thought I was. So these have been hard-won lessons, I'd say, Lisa. And it's definitely where I look back and think, oh, how could you have been so simplistic or short-sighted? But I'd package them in a few different ways. So one would be the power of purpose and having a really clear vision for what your purpose is, what your why is. That can be transformative. And I'll use a sporting example, but I definitely think it reads across to any environment. So in terms of having a why before, when I'd competed, tried to put myself in a competitive, high-performing environment, I'll probably like triathlon or running races, something like that. It was all intrinsic, my why was. It was self-imposed sort of pressure. It was right, come on, perform as well as you can. And when I look back on those races, whilst I might have done reasonably well, every morning I'd wake up to the race and I'd feel sick in the pit of my stomach. I'd be really nervous. And all of that was pressure which I'd imposed upon myself. And I think that would be the same pressure you might feel in big work projects. Maybe you're delivering something, it's a big presentation. But the big life-changing event when I sort of had the epiphany at Isla's bedside in hospital, it became about something much more than myself. It became a huge extrinsic motivation. And this was to try and connect with my daughter, and it was also to try and raise money to the people who saved her life. And that became so powerful. Every time, every one of those five challenges done each year, they were beyond what I'd done before. At first it was a triple marathon, then it was a 100 kilometers, then it was 100 miles, then it was rowing the Atlantic. Each one was so much more than I'd ever achieved. But at the start line, I didn't feel nervous. I didn't feel sick because it was about so much more than me. It was about this vision for doing something so much more powerful. And I knew that I was doing it for Isla. I knew I was doing it for everyone that had supported her. And it was so powerful. So out of that, and I think the lesson, Lisa, is that if you've got a really clear vision which people buy into, it can be so powerful in terms of getting the most out of yourself, also those around you.
I completely agree with that. And I mean, for me, purpose is absolutely key. I talk a lot about meaning and purpose. So a question for you is, your sense of purpose became very apparent because of what happened with Isla. A lot of people don't know, aren't crystal clear about what their sense of purpose is. They almost drift a bit more because they opportunities arise and they just find themselves in a particular role or a particular situation. What would your advice be to people who say, oh, I'm not really sure what my purpose is?
Yeah, we don't get sat down, do we? We do maths, we do a bit of English, a bit of science, but no one sits down and helps you build your purpose, do they? But I think it's a really powerful sort of lesson. So I read this fantastic book by Brad Stuhlenberg. Forgive me, I will have to come back to the title on this
That's
one.
fine. We'll put it in the show notes.
But within it had this really powerful exercise in how to define your purpose. And it's one which I have adapted and I use with my coaching clients now. I've done it for myself. I've got my purpose written down here. I read it every morning. And genuinely, it holds me to account every day, helps make sure all my activity is helping to support my purpose in some way. So I find it really powerful. But the exercise of defining a purpose, which I find a really user-friendly version and quite quick. I say quite quick, it's something you can revisit and work with over a long period of time. But it involves figuring out what are your core values. So it's quite helpful to stimulate someone who's doing the exercise with you by maybe giving them a list of about 50 core values and then allowing them to figure out which of those resonate most strongly with them. Maybe it's five. And then taking those five core values and trying to contextualize it for their life. So for me, it might be inspire. Okay, what does inspire mean in the context of my life? I want to inspire people. And then it's about ranking those core values. So you'll rank them. And then finally, the tough bit is taking those contextualized, ranked core values and then turning them into two or three sentences. And I did it first back in 2019. And mine has changed remarkably little. I find it so powerful. As I say, I genuinely read it every morning, Monday to Friday. I give myself the weekend off.
But I think it, but it's, I mean, you know, you were saying earlier about how unprepared you were when, you know, you thought you were doing really well in life and everything was perfect, and you realize actually how unprepared you were, and you weren't, you know, in terms of being resilient and so on, actually, you hadn't mastered that. And I think a lot of people are remarkably underprepared. They are just, they find themselves in certain roles and it's assumed that they therefore come with all the knowledge and all the skills and the mindset and everything else that's required for that role. And there are a lot of people who are treading water. And, you know, we talk about imposter syndrome and so on. This is kind of this, you know, your feeling that you were referring to earlier of the nerves and so on. A lot of people are feeling that day in, day out going into work. It's like, I don't know, am I going to be showing up today, or am I doing this right? Or actually, I don't know how to do this, so I'm going to default to some really unhealthy behaviors to cover up the fact that I don't feel secure in what I'm doing. And I think if we go back to the basics of who we are fundamentally and what drives us, and we're clear about our values, that we can shape our roles, shape our existence to so we can live those values, then we end up, if life feels fulfilling and it feels much more natural and much easier to engage with, and we can just be much more authentic, going full circle back to what you started off by saying. And it take and I think just that shift in terms of how we think about how we're supposed to show up, and aligning how we show up much more with how we want to show up and what feels right to us, everything just feels a lot simpler, doesn't it?
Does, yeah. I think training in some organizations can be very good, but it's often on the technical side of the training. The military exceptional at training you to fly airplanes, drive tanks, drive ships, but it doesn't necessarily prepare you emotionally, psychologically, for when it really gets tough. And I suspect organizations in the civilian world possibly undershoot on some of the technical training because they don't have the luxury of infinite amounts of time to train, or a big budget like the military does to train to prepare for the worst case. So that feeling of imposter syndrome, I can absolutely understand, and I guess part of it is one trying to get people into the place where they can be vulnerable and say, I need help, put the hand up. And actually get that support. But two, it's just that investment in training our people. So many organizations talk about, people being the priority, but are they living that value? I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the training, I think I agree a lot of places aren't investing enough in training, but I think also they are investing then in training that is not necessarily very effective. So, for example, the working with Gemma Ellison, doing lots of stuff around our leadership labs, and we always do a lot in that around who we are as a leader. And you ask that, no, there are MDs, there are very senior leaders, and you know, people who have been in leadership roles for a long time in this group, and they're like, wow, I never really thought about that. You know, they've gone through the whole career to that point and have never really thought about who they are, who they want to be, or what brings out the best in them, and what they want their experience to feel like, what other people need from them, which actually probably matches quite close to what they want to be able to do, but other stuff gets in the way. You know, what we think is important, like our inbox or ticking off these things on our checklist, or and the training can then end up being still, even if it's a leadership type training, much more about kind of the technical side of that, rather than, again, the human side. And I still don't think there's enough emphasis on people being clear about their values and their sense of purpose and how to relate well to people, and you know, just the normal stuff about just interaction and coping and being our best selves on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, it's can you create that space for those healthy discussions? Can you provide people? It might not be coaching. It might be we have something called reverse mentorship. I don't know if you're familiar with that. You
Yeah,
are, yeah.
but explain it to the listeners, because I think it's brilliant.
Okay, no, I mean it's a good concept. I'm not sure how well it's actually practiced, but it's something the military is trying to adopt, and it's actually leaders recognize they don't learn everything from those above them or those who've gone before. Actually, those around you and those who you have a leadership responsibility to, they can help mentor you. They can help shape you. They can see your flaws often so much more clearly than those above, those who you're trying to impress. So actually getting that feedback and getting that support is a really, really healthy thing. I guess it's almost like an informal 360 reporting. Again, something the military is not ready to embrace, but it's how can you get the feedback that you need to be the best you? And it's not necessarily going to come from those who are above you within an organization.
So you started off by talking about the power of purpose as number one. What would be a number two then in another lesson or another piece of advice?
So I'm gonna take a wimpish option and actually just add to that power of purpose if you don't mind. So I'll explain the situation and why. And I think it's about a clear vision, but it's also about a shared vision. So I'd say that'd probably be the second point. It's a shared vision. And in some of the earlier challenges I did, I had a laser-like focus on what my vision was. And it was quite clearly connecting with Isla, and it was raising money. But when I brought in three incredible teammates to help row across the Atlantic, I realized it couldn't all be about me. And actually, that would be really unhealthy if I forced my purpose, my vision upon them. So this was about adopting a shared vision, understanding what they needed, what they wanted. But I think it's quite powerful for any organization, and quite typically, a vision or a purpose statement, a mission statement. These things are decided by often a very small minority within the company and just pushed out for everyone to adopt. And then when you ask them 6 months later, what's our mission statement? It's not really a surprise. No one knows what it is. No one really resonates with it. So I guess what came from my experience on the boat was we spent a lot of time peeling back the layers. What was really important to each of us? And we agreed, one, we're very competitive individuals, so it was to try and win the race. Two, there was the supporting the campaign, which was to try and raise as much money for an incredible children's cancer charity. But the third one, which came out of it, was we called it the granddad test. And this is when we're all granddads, are we going to be bouncing each other's grandchildren on our knees, telling them stories? And they became so powerful. And actually, even though I had what was a great vision early on, actually incorporating, the objectives, the needs, and the wants of the rest of the team was really powerful. So when I now work with teams and organizations, I always challenge them on their vision. How are they doing it? And I think there's four ways of creating a vision. It can be very much command-led. Military very good at this. This is your mission statement. Go do it. It can be consultative, where you're asking opinions, you're getting feedback, but ultimately it's your decision, or the decision sits at the top. Or it can be truly collaborative. This is where, as a team or an organization, collectively, you're going to discuss, agree, and then decide what it's going to look like. Or it could be delegate. And delegate, that could be absolving yourself of responsibility, or it could be quite powerful. You're a sub team, or you're a nodule within this organization. We want you to be empowered to come up with your own vision. So four ways: command, consultative, collaborative, and then there's the delegation. I think each have their time and purpose. But I think if we can spend more time in the sort of collaborate area, I think it's so much more powerful. people believe it, people resonate with it, and they'll do more because they share that vision.
Yeah, I like that. And I think it ties really well with what you were saying earlier about, you know, talking about strengths in terms of, you know, you like it when a leader is able to put the hand up and say, I'm not a great public speaker, or whatever their part of their role that they don't love doing, or they're not great at doing. And when you've got a shared vision, that shared purpose, and it's like, right, we're all bought into this, we've all helped create this, you then got to look at the resources, haven't you, to achieve that.
Yeah.
And that then leads really nicely into that conversation around what our strengths are within a group. And for me, again, that's really powerful, because too many people get stuck with, this is my role and this is my job description, and that comes under my remit, so I've got to do it even if I don't like it and not very good at it. And when we can get rid of those kind of almost the false boundaries and barriers to us collaborating, and just talk about, we all agree with what we want to do. This is our mission now. This is, you know, we're excited about it. How are we going to do it? And you almost forget people's job titles and, you know, what they think they're supposed to be doing. And you get around like a proper team, almost like a team challenge. Like, how are we going to do this? And get people excited and motivated, which is far from what you see on a day-to-day basis. And it's like, well, you're doing that, because that's what comes into your role. So it's flipping around, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely, Lisa. Yeah, spot on.
So what? So when we think about, we've got a clear purpose, they've got a clear vision, and you've got the leader who's demonstrating authenticity and vulnerability.
Yeah,
I'm assuming from your point of view that those are some of the key ingredients for that team then to be able to perform well, because they're motivated, they're bought into it, they're enabled to speak up. It's demonstrating all this kind of psychological safety in terms of being able to challenge and being able to introduce new ideas and so on. So those are some of the key ingredients, you think, for high performance.
Absolutely. I think they're definitely some of the key pillars from my perspective to unlock a team's potential.
So can we ask for number three? Have we got time for
number
three?
Okay. So I think another one is adversity. So adversity, it's something which often is interpreted as something purely bad. You know, it's a tough time. However, I think there's something incredible within adversity which allows us to grow. In my experience, I would not wish, you know, having a 22-month-old daughter with leukemia on anyone. But oh my God, I'm such a better person because of that experience. I know my wife is, I know as a family we are, and I know in terms of my outlook and how I can operate now, it's so much better because I've lived through that adversity. So I think it's about trying to seek the opportunity within adversity and hardship. Part of it is in reframing it. So I think reframing an adversity would be this one, Lisa. So when things are really tough, if you're able to just shine a light on it from a different perspective, I think it can be so much more manageable. And I'm going to take you back to the rowing boat again now to help me explain this analogy. So it's 3 o'clock in the morning. You've had the most horrendous 2 hours on the oars. It's been raining. Your hands are sore. Flesh is hanging off them. You're 1,500 miles from land. You're tired. You're hungry. Everything hurts. And you're just about to hand over to your teammate. Now, it'd be really easy just to have a good old moan at this point.
Yeah.
You've got an opportunity to reframe that situation for the individual. If you tell them that we've had a side wind, which has made it really difficult to row, if you tell them about every little ache you've got in your body, you're not setting them up for a good 2 hour shift at 3 in the morning. But if you pull out some positives, if you talk about, hey, earlier on, I was able to see the bioluminescence in the water with every oar stroke. Or I saw this bird earlier today. It was incredible. We're 1,500 miles from land and we're still seeing wildlife out here. Or, we're just about to go through a milestone of halfway across. We've done half an ocean. You're setting them up for success. And I think we can use this in any context in life. In the workplace, if you start a team meeting off with a massive moan, it doesn't set you up for success. But if you pull out the positives, you can reframe it in a really powerful way. And it seems a really simple trick, but you can use it in so many different ways. I used to have a 3-hour commute every Sunday night to a job. And at first, I was like, ugh, 3 hours, dread, Sunday night, not what I want. But I reframed it as my personal development journey. I'd spend half an hour picking out some great podcasts or an audio book. And I'd play those over the 2 or 3 hours, or I'd phone my dad or my great nana. We'd have this amazing sort of chat. But by the end of it, I was looking forward to those 2, 3 hour journeys because I got so much out of the podcast and the conversations I was having. And I'd say a final one is when it's really tough. Think about what this is helping you to become. Lots of great phrases out there. When you're marching through hell, keep marching. The darkest hour is the one just before dawn. This was really powerful to me on the row, and I was able to reframe that by comparing it to what my daughter was going through. And the first night on the boat, all those strange noises, I thought of her first night in hospital. Or when bits were aching, I was like, this is nothing. It's 30 odd days. My daughter's going through 2.5 years of this. This is nothing. That's exactly the same on this the 100-mile race this weekend, by the way. I was like, it's one day. You can start feeling sorry for yourself right now. It's one day. People are going through far worse. So I think it's adverse. It's, I guess, reframing is the technique, and that is taking the same sensory or data input, but using it to your advantage, and also seeing adversity as something that you can grow from, something you can develop. That's something you can thrive under. It's
It's such good examples, and your story demonstrates that really well, communicates that really well. I think when I talk a lot about reframing, and some people really struggle to reframe. You can have a particular situation, they're just so stuck in it. I think when people's emotional arousal is high, they're finding something very stressful, to be able to step outside and see that situation from a different perspective can be quite challenging. And that's again going back to what you said at the start, that your wife is really good at about accepting help and having those connections with other people. When we can ask other people their opinion, how else can we see it? And I talk about putting a particular challenge on the table. So, imagine taking out of you your whatever you're thinking, putting it on the table. What would your best friend say? What would your mum say? Or what would your colleague at work say about that situation? Just to try and help people see it from a different perspective, if they struggle themselves, to put a different spin on it, but a different, have see it in a different way. Because I think some people like the idea, and on the simplest form, a simplest way, I'll often say just put the end, the word yet on the end. Like, I haven't learnt, I'm rubbish at Excel spreadsheets. Well, you haven't learnt to master them yet. It's like that sense of possibility that something can change. But I think when we bring in other people and we can use other people's perceptions to help us reframe, that can also be really helpful if we're feeling so stuck in our own way of thinking that we're struggling to see other people's angles.
It's knowing your own weaknesses, right? I mean, you've just given a couple of really good examples there, but I mean, you and I, we love reframing. We recognize the power, but it's still probably things where we could take a much more optimistic or positive perspective on it.
And also, like, De Bono's thinking hats. I always remember did some work with someone called Amanda Page. We did some projects with some leadership teams, and she bought this whole set of these thinking hats, and everyone on the leadership team had to put a different hat on at a different time. And depending on what colour hat meant that they had to think about the particular challenge in that particular way. So it might be, okay, we're going to think about all the doom and gloom, like what could possibly go wrong, and let's get it out there. There are some people who are naturally more inclined to see what potentially can go wrong in the situation. So actually, but let's air that. It's vital we hear that. And then let's take that hat off and let's put a different one on, which is about creativity. So how could we be creative about this particular situation? So let's think outside the box. Let's come up with really crazy ideas, because we're giving ourselves permission to do that. So I think being able to very consciously and explicitly play around with different mindsets and doing that as a collective as well could be a lot of fun. And again, it highlights what people's strengths are, in terms of some people are naturally more creative than others, or some people are much more cautious. But again, you need that variety of people on a team.
Yeah, I love the hat idea. It's really powerful because it gives a voice to each perspective. We strive to have these inclusive and diverse teams, and actually having that diversity of thought, it leads to a much more powerful output if you can harness it.
Yeah.
I look back to my early days on a flying squadron, and I look back now and I'm horrified. At the time, I thought we had the best team. They were very good at what they did, but they were all male, white, probably pretty much all middle class, probably a very similar educational background, and diversity. It was like looking through a drinking straw.
Yeah.
Yes, for that one job, but wow, we must have had so many blind spots. And I look at the military as a whole, and I remember charting from my position, going all the way up through different chains of command. You got to the chief of the RAF, the chief of defense staff, all the way to Secretary of State. All of them were white, middle-aged males. I was like, wow. Are we really harnessing the full diversity which we've got in our great country? Probably not.
And that's where I think things like the reverse mentoring work so well, because you've got new ideas. You've got, you know, when you're really making the most of people who are new into an organization, and rather than you're new in, we're going to teach you everything, taking the view of you're new in, tell us what we can do better, tell us how we can think differently, because otherwise we just maintain the status quo. This is like how we've always done stuff, so this we'll carry on doing like that. To actually actively look for opportunities to challenge how we do things. And there's nothing better than when you get someone new into the organization and, you know, grow their status in terms of, we're going to learn from you. You need to tell us what our blind spots are. And actually, I mean, that's a win-win for both, you know, for everyone there. The new person's suddenly like, wow, I'm not kind of considered bottom of the pecking order, and I've got to wait till I can have my voice heard. It's like they're asking for my opinion, and this is my opportunity to share what I'm observing.
Constructive dissent. That's I don't know if is that a term you use?
Or... Well, I've heard, yes, a little, well, not so much consciously, but I've heard of that before, but I like that term.
Yeah, but again, that requires a bit of trust. It requires a lot of vulnerability from the leadership to accept, yes, I've been here 20 years, but I am not nailing it. We could be so much better.
Yeah, that's... And that goes full circle back to where you started with about vulnerability and authenticity. And I think if more leaders in particular could, regardless of what stage they're at, you know, 10 years into a particular role, say, you know what, I'm actually going to be really honest, I haven't quite nailed this bit, or I've never really understood that, or whatever it is, without this whole like, I'm supposed to know it all by now. If everyone could just be a little bit more honest with themselves and others, I think we have been a very different place.
Too right, too right.
Bill, that's three very, very useful messages, actually, because what I normally ask my guests at the end of a conversation is, what would be your two or three pieces of advice for people to go away and think about or put into practice, or, you know, to take away and use. You've talked about the power of purpose and values, and you've talked about adversity. You've talked about shared vision. You covered so much. Is there anything else that you think, you, as a summary, you'd want to say, you know, if you're going to leave this conversation with something, this is it?
So I don't think now is the time to introduce new ideas. I think the clear purpose is incredible. If you can really drill down to what your purpose is, it can be like a North Star. And that idea of drifting, which you talked about, I think so many of us can find ourselves in jobs, roles, or life in general drifting. Purpose can be really powerful for helping motivate you, keep you on track, and make those right decisions. Power of vulnerability. I mean, it's been a game changer for me. I've had a complete 180 on my approach to what I thought good leadership, what I thought high performance was. And actually, I see vulnerability as a huge strength now. So it's being willing to take that leap of faith and actually show your vulnerability. You'll get so much more out of those around you. And as a team, you'll do so much better. And I guess, yeah, adversity. There's so many books out there, great books. I think there's Comfort Crisis by Michael Easter, which I'm currently enjoying. It's all about that, I guess, the opportunity to grow by challenging yourself. And Ryan Holiday's Obstacle is the Way, another great book. And actually, it's recognizing that adversity, stress, trauma, yes, these might not be things which we want, but there's an opportunity there to grow, to build resilience and to learn. For me, I had a gaping hole in what I thought my understanding of resilience was. And for me, the penny drop moment is resilience is also about using those around you, knowing and understanding your network and knowing how to leverage them to help support you to be the best you. That's I guess those would be the big three, Lisa, if I was to pick on any.
Thank you so much, Phil. I have I could carry on listening to you and sharing your ideas and sharing your stories and for hours. We have to stop, but I'm really grateful for you giving up your time today to share some of what you've learnt from your life experience so far, personal and professional. There are lots of nuggets of ideas there for people to take away and think, actually, yeah, maybe I do need to think a little bit more about this or a little bit more about that, and either for myself and with my team. So I'm really, really grateful. I hope you've enjoyed sitting down and staying stationary for a little while and your legs haven't seized up entirely. And yeah, we'll put your details in the show notes. I'll make sure that we got the book recommendations from you. We'll put links to those in the show notes as well. And people can reach out to you if they're interested in finding out more. So thank you so much, Phil.
Oh, what a pleasure. Yeah, always amazing to chat with you, Lisa. Thanks for having me on. And thanks for giving me 60 minutes to sit down.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. What have you taken from it? What has it inspired you to think about or do differently? Please give the podcast a simple thumbs up on Apple or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And I'd be especially grateful if you leave a short review. It makes a real difference. If you join the club, you'll be the first to hear about relevant updates and free downloadable resources that are part of developing practice and performance. Do reach out to me directly to discuss your challenges at work. And if we're not already acquainted on LinkedIn, let's connect. All the links you need are in the show notes. Until next time, bye for now.